has voted to leave the European Union.
Markets got it wrong. The bookies got it wrong.
A UK vote to exit the European Union could have significant economic repercussion.
The British vote to leave the EU sending markets plummeting.
The British, when they leave the European Union, open up the European Union to not collapse, but unraveling.
The fact that one of the milder affected countries is basically throwing up their hands and saying, I'm done with this, is an indicator they got a tough future.
People want to take their country back. They want to have independence in a sense. And you see it with Europe, all over Europe. You're going to have more than just what happened last night.
June the 23rd needs to become a national bank holiday, and we will call it Independence Day.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, what a week it was. It started out with Janet Yellen up on Capitol Hill, less sanguine than she was in the past, and we thought we'd be talking about the Fed. But guess what? Brexit happened. That's the big story this week. It had all kinds of implications for the market, as we saw some of the biggest convulsions in trading markets in a 24-hour period. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Dan Wojtrowski will be joining me. Dan still, believe it or not, given the events of what happened on Friday, he's still pretty optimistic that, well, we could be seeing higher stock prices, believe it or not. You want to hear why he feels that way? Also, my good friend David Morgan will be joining us as we take a look at the precious metals market. And, of course, Ryan Poplava will talk about what moved the markets this week. I think there's one main story, and, well, you're going to hear about it 24 hours a day for the next 3 days. It was Brexit.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, we've been playing the game of will they or won't they, with that, largely with the Fed. But as far as Great Britain, the answer is they did. And as Jim just said, that's going to be the subject of conversation. Can you make sense of all of this? Why, funny you should ask. That's what we're going to do during the big picture today, is dissect what's been going on. Who were the winners? Who were the losers? Where is this all likely to lead? What does it do for the dollar? And are there similar scenarios roaring around the world where people feel pretty much the same about some of the same issues? All of that. And by the way, Keith Barron will weigh in from Europe as well on the big picture today on the Financial Sense News Hour. It's been interesting lately how many gorillas there have been in the room about various political and economic issues. And a lot of the politically correct elites in our politicos don't really want to deal with them on a reality basis. And everybody else seems to be noticing the gorillas in the room when it comes to terrorism or to economics or to the situation in Europe. That's the way it is. And I think what we need to do is pick out one particular gorilla here, Ryan Poplava, and talk about the 1,000-pound gorilla in the room. Did you really actually think we were going to have the kind of upset we got on Friday? I mean, with the UK referendum settling at, what, about 52% to exit, especially when early on they're going, they're going to stay in, they're going to stay in, they're going to stay in. Wait a minute! And then everybody went, what? And then, of course, the markets just went crazy worldwide.
Yeah, I think the double take was last night, just watching the television, seeing what was going on. And I think they had assumed that, yeah, it was going to be a remain vote all the way up towards that last like 1 or 2 hours. And then boom, what an upset. And definitely caught the market off guard, because, you know, leading up to this point, the market had been rallying with the expectation that, looking at all the recent polls starting from Monday, they would remain. So, no, John, it definitely caught me off guard, because, you know, I tend to agree with the market and believe that the market prices in most things and tries to discount expectations. But I did feel like on Thursday, I was talking to Chris Poplava with the rally before the results, before we closed, just based on many polls in just the past in favor of the exit, that the market was, I think, celebrating a little bit too early. And definitely, I sensed some complacency was being priced in. So I was definitely glad to see the S&P settle down in the early morning on Friday, right around 2050, that was a sign that complacency was removed. But the finish on the day towards 2037 basically tells me that some fear is still settling in here and could show up early next week. But, you know, John, you know, a couple of days off to digest the information will be good for investors, because that's what needs to happen. Because what we got was definitely a shoot first, market was off guard, ask questions later. Let's see how things mull over the weekend. That's not to say the political ramifications here aren't huge. They are, spanning over the next few months and years to come, as, you know, other countries do their own referendum votes. And then from there, you know, it gets the legislature get involved. Negotiations will take place between the EU and these members, which, you know, that can span over the term of 2 years. And if they're still talking about it at that point, I believe it's set up automatically that a member can leave.
Well, I got a call from Harold Hoffman, who has been running one of these anti-EU sites in the UK, and he had been up all night and all day. And when he called me, it was like 3 o'clock on Friday, and he was still high. He could not come down, you know, because for him it had been so significant that they could actually do this. It's almost like the mouse that roared. And Jim and I are going to go into a lot of detail on the big picture, and then Keith Barron's going to join us. He lives in Switzerland, lived for a long time in the UK, so he'll join us on the big picture to try to dissect all of this means. Now, let's face it, it all came about overnight, Thursday, Friday, for those of us here in North America. And then the markets went through its gyration here and then fluttered down. So when we came to the end of the day, it only had one day to do all of this. What areas were the worst hit?
Well, as the clocks started ticking overseas first, those areas were hit pretty bad. And then also the ramifications are a little bit more for obviously all the different areas in Europe than the US right now. The main indexes for some of those areas like Spain, they were down. Spain was down 12%. That's huge. France down 8%. Germany was down 6.8%. What this vote means for these EU countries, and nobody knows the certainty there because there is none. Then there's the FTSE, the FTSE 100 dropped 3.15% in the UK. So Asia was the hardest hit. Nikkei was the hardest hit there. It was down about 7.9%. I think the Shanghai didn't move down all that much. It was down like 1.3%, right around there. You know, those were the markets in general that were hit the hardest. It was the equities, definitely.
Okay, well, now how about here in the States? I saw that the markets were down somewhere between 3 and 4%, depending on the index right now. What about currencies, commodities, rates, bonds, any of those things?
We were actually, like I said, we were holding fairly well as we were heading lower. The futures last night were actually even lower than where we closed today. The futures, at one point I was looking 10 o'clock Pacific time. The S&P at that point was down like 100 points on the futures. Dow was 700. So it was definitely a little bit more bleak than where we closed at the end of the day on Friday. But yeah, the hardest hit areas in equities, it was the financials, because of how closely they are tied to currencies, the economy, exposure to investments there in Europe, interest rates, which are influenced by economic activity and central banks. So those were the most negatively affected. Then there's the safety trade here in the U.S., which is, for us, it's gold. And then the U.S. dollar is a global reserve currency that's typically in the past when global events like this happen, there has been a flight to safety in the U.S. dollar into U.S. treasury. So yes, U.S. Treasuries also rallied, yields dropped. But you know, any long-term dollar strength, as we've seen over the past 2 years, as you and I have been talking about that story, which leveled off this year, is that kind of strength can hurt commodity prices overall. We've seen commodity prices drop over the last few years. And then there's the earnings situation for multinationals. Starting from, I believe, January of 2015, when we were talking about the fourth quarter in 2013, a lot of companies were talking about how the strength in the U.S. dollar had hurt their earnings for the multinationals. Not so much for, obviously, U.S. companies specifically, especially the smaller cap companies, which typically just deal with state-to-state dealings. But, you know, the closing high in January for gold was around 1308. Today, in closing at around 1319, that was a new closing high, a new 52-week high for the metal. So definitely a flight to safety there. We saw some speculation jumping into gold ahead of the vote, and so we were a little bit cautious about adding more exposure than what we already had put on earlier this year, especially since looking at the polls previous to this point, you know, Bermain was scheduled to beat Brexit. Gold rallied quite strongly.
Okay, so financials were hit hardest, and it sounds like, well, maybe what, bonds, gold, and the dollar were really the only place to hide. It's really hard to gauge right now if this is a black swan event for the markets, although they should have seen this swan coming, at least the potential for it, or maybe part of a bigger problem in a bigger picture. And that's what Jim and I are going to try to unravel at the big picture here later on in the program, getting into a lot of details, really getting down into the weeds. So we'll have to see where that goes.
Yeah, John, there's definitely a lot to talk about now as opposed to a Bermain story. But you know, one difference I don't think really, I haven't heard anybody talk about this, which kind of surprises me, is that you know the UK has been maintaining its own currency, its own central bank, and it has its own natural borders of water surrounding it compared to some of the other EU members. So those other nations may find it harder to rationalize or argue separation, but we'll see. I think of any of the members, the UK had the easiest surroundings and items in discussing that separation. It will definitely be a large tale to tell over the next few months and the next year. Euro hasn't fallen out of bed yet and continues to be range bound. Watching the currencies will be very important going forward. Obviously, many central banks may react to any kind of contagion that stems from this, like we saw with the European sovereign debt crisis. So definitely we're going to be watching currencies, and the yen in particular right now is the currency in focus for us in the days to come, and whether the Bank of Japan steps in more aggressively. They haven't done something since the first quarter, so, and I think it's a high probability they will.
Anybody remember Janet Yellen? She spoke earlier this week.
Before the Senate Banking Committee and the Financial Services House Committee. Yeah, it was mainly status quo, and that's why I don't really bring it up. Didn't really influence the markets all that much.
That was before the sit-in in Congress, remember, this week. What a week. It's just been a really wild week. Okay, Ryan, any other stress indicators you and your brother follow that might help us in determining, well, the risk to the markets near-term, and then what catalysts are on the horizon that would help shape the narrative coming up for the rest of the summer?
Definitely the headlines are going to shape sentiment and the multiple on the market right now. Earnings are still right around 120 for the S&P. Looking at stress indicators, we haven't seen anything in particular that has us very concerned like we did back in January. The stress indicators were starting to really flash some serious concerns. A lot of technicians were talking about bear markets at that time. The VIX is one of the main risk indicators I follow. That's the volatility index, as well as the Chicago Board of Options Exchange Index put to call ratios. Essentially, the index over the equity put to call ratio, because you find managers typically will hedge their investments. You call these smarter managers over retail investors. That's just what the market does or what technicians do. So they look at the index put to call ratios as opposed to these equity ones to see if managers are hedging. And those have definitely risen as of late. So definitely a heightened sense of nervousness in that volatility index and the index put to call ratio. And we saw the same thing in January and August of last year. Sometimes, you know, that can typically show exhaustion. And if it does, I look for signs the bulls are taking back control, like an intraday rally well off the low. And we did kind of see that with the futures last night, showing a lot more dire situation than what, you know, I came into when the market opened. Now, we didn't see that Friday. It's possible more risk-off actions could take place next week. But, you know, after next week's reaction to the trading today, that's where I'll be focusing. We'll be looking towards the June employment data and all the economic news that we will get after the 4th that will kind of paint the U.S. picture. But as you know, John, we've been stating, you know, my brother and I, Jim, since November, you know, we believe that we're in that final phase of the bull market. We did it in our financial strategy meeting that we opened up to all of our listeners for the first time in 10 years. And, you know, we've already begun moving into a more neutral posture towards equities and more exposure to bonds, you know, defensive areas. Like I said, we have a gold exposure. So we haven't seen enough economic news yet to change that narrative, even with a better GDP print estimated for the second quarter and for, you know, good retail sales figures we saw just a few weeks ago. We haven't seen the earnings lift or profitability warrant us adding more risk exposure with, you know, just valuations are still relatively high.
Well, maybe some of the oncoming weeks will be as exciting as this week was. I always enjoy that.
Yeah, we thought it was going to be a yawn, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, usually with Janet Yellen on Capitol Hill, it's like, will they or won't they? Well, we may raise it and we may not, but considering the data, since we're data dependent, you know, and about that point, it's okay, she ain't going to do it. And that's it.
Yeah.
You know?
There was no surprises, nothing there.
Yeah, nothing.
You know, there was one time, I can remember 2 summers ago, she said biotech was overvalued and wow, that moved the market. And she talked about when she could possibly raise rates, gave like a date range, and that moved the market. So it's not always a yawner, but it was this week.
All right, Ryan Poplava, hope to see you again next week, and we'll see how things not unravel, but develop, especially in terms of the Brexit and everything else.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. You know, all these risk indicators are pointing towards exhaustion for the near term. Let's see what happens. We're going to look at the headlines, and the headlines are going to shape sentiment, so do some reading.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
One of the most important political issues facing Europe this year will occur on Thursday, June 23rd, when British citizens head to the polls to decide whether, after 45 long years, if the UK should exit the EU. We are joined today by two leading analysts at Global Risk Insights, Michaela Sorensen and Nandini Rao, to understand why, as many are stating, that this is one of the most important macroeconomic issues facing the world today. I would take it that the EU is maximizing the chances of a stay-in vote by delaying Greece bailout and some other hot-button issues, that if a Brexit did indeed happen, if the vote were to be to leave, that would be quite disruptive given the amount of pressure for a stay-in.
Yeah, for sure. I think especially the financial market reaction would be quite severe, because I think expectations and the international community believe in a stay vote.
I'll just benefit with me also basic questions about the EU's future as a vote to exit might result in other countries clamoring for their own referendum. This is likely to be the case in France if the National Front wins. So this could lead to questions about the durability of the Union. So it could definitely be a shock to markets, which could have long-term impact.
Well, since the beginning of the year, we've seen all kinds of actions in the market. The market started the year on a down note, and then we had a nice rally. But since then, the markets have been capped. Many say we're in a range-bound market. Joining us on the program is Dan Wojtrowski from Albion Partners. And Dan, what's going on? It seems like we've had a correction in time. We've hit lows, we've hit highs, but for the most part, for the almost year and a half now, the market has been range-bound. I don't care if you're looking at the S&P 500 or yields on 10-year treasuries. What's going on here?
Yeah, well, that's the million-dollar question, I guess. Yeah, we've looked at this a bunch of different ways and found one thing of interest. You had mentioned the term, you know, correction in time. I'd say that really sums it up perfectly. You know, since 2000, back when, you know, we had the height of the tech bubble, you had a multiple on the S&P, you know, north of 40 times. The next 15 years saw extremely wide trading ranges and cyclical swings in the market. What they didn't see were any of these more sort of less significant, you know, corrections in time, as you put it, or these sort of consolidation periods. And what we found when you go back through history, secular bull cycles, this type of market pattern that lasts several months is actually very common. I'm calling it sort of the brave new world of trading, because when you think about it, investors today haven't seen this type of market consolidation for nearly 15 years. So I think it caught a lot of people off guard. And as you said, know, the S&P in a trading range for about a year. What's even more interesting, perhaps, is that small caps, you look at the Russell 2000, have been in that type of trading range for nearly 2 years now. The trading range in small and mid-cap stocks actually began in early 2014. So you have this huge consolidation period that lasts months. It cycles through each of the different sectors and stocks without completely crippling the market indices. It's something investors weren't used to, and I think it's caused a lot of frustration. You know, the other thing I think we would have to contend with is simply the market multiple. However you calculate it, stocks are not necessarily cheap. You know, I look at a trailing 12 multiple on the S&P 500 today, anywhere from, let's say, 18 to 20 times. When we go back throughout history, we look at prior cyclical market tops, and I'm not talking history of the last 10, 15 years. I'm talking the history 50, 60 years of looking at this multiple and studying how it sort of oscillates between its own overbought and oversold territories. You could very well argue that we're pushing up against a level where the markets need to consolidate and perhaps pull that multiple back a little bit. Now, again, one way you can do that is through a cyclical bear market. And that's not really so much a correction in time. That is a massive correction in price. And again, that's what investors were used to. 2000 to 2002, 2007, 2009, these were massive, massive bear markets. Or you can settle things the trickier way through these sort of stealth corrections in time, in which you take down the multiple of individual stocks and sectors. You leave a few still hanging as safe havens and the broader indices, and you kind of improve your valuation metric in that sense. I tend to think that's kind of where we're at. So as the S&P hit into the 2100 with a multiple of 19, 20 times, given all the uncertainty that's out there, we're staring at Brexit in the face. I mean, that should be resolved, obviously, today, tomorrow. But beyond that, uncertainty surrounding Fed policy, a huge uncertainty surrounding our U.S. election season that's coming up. I mean, this has given investors, and specifically I'm talking about institutions who really are running the tape and have been running the tape for the last several years, this gives them a reason to kind of stand on the sidelines. So we see volumes certainly lightened. The market becomes choppy. You're unable to break above that 2100 zone. Your multiple gives people reason to say, well, things aren't ridiculously cheap. Valuations aren't perfect here. So let's take a breather. And I do think that's what's happening. My opinion is that this is occurring all within the context of a bull market cycle, a secular bull market cycle. You and I have spoken in the past. We do look at these secular cycles. I believe they're very important. These are longer-term trends that sort of exist underneath the surface of our day-to-day, volatility and swings. The typical duration here is anywhere from 10 to 15 years, these huge movements. I think that's what we're in. I think it began sometime around 2012, 2013, so in the early innings. And so when we combine that with this velocity of this brave new world, these types of sideways consolidation periods that could last, 12, 15 months being common in secular bull market cycles, I think that effectively gives us our answer. So that's kind of what we're looking at. I think the ultimate resolution to this is going to be upwards. I think the markets eventually do break out of, the S&P's benchmark 2100. One of the things we've been watching very closely is market breadth. And if you look at breadth, that's participation, stocks and sectors that are actually moving and keeping this thing afloat. Breadth is very healthy currently. In fact, breadth measures, if you were to use the NYSE Cumulative Advanced Decline Line, which is what we use, recently broke out to new all-time highs, and it looks like they're pressuring themselves to do it again. So as the markets are moving sideways, breadth is actually now leading price. That's something we think is very healthy. We'd call it actually a bullish divergence, as opposed to a negative divergence where price would advance without breadth. Price advancing without breadth tells me that the S&P is making higher highs just on the backs of one or two few names. In 2012, it was Apple. Apple in 2012 drove 3% of the S&P gains at one point. That's huge. Today, you see no single stock contribution like that. The closest we have this year was ExxonMobil, believe it or not, driving less than 0.5% of the S&P's meager gains. And it's funneled out, and it's much more broader based. So I do think that breadth is an important key to watch here. Even though the markets are sort of moving sideways and taking a breather, I think that's telling me ultimately that the direction is going to be higher. Now, timing is obviously a question. You know, seasonality will come into effect. Election year cycle studies will come into effect. You know, my sense is that we have a moderate upward bias into the early August timeframe. We'd possibly take another breather at that point, go through a, you know, minor corrective cycle. You know, what does that mean? You know, anywhere upwards of, you know, 10% correction. 10% correction at this point would be significant, in my opinion. But after that, I think you're going to push and break out to new all-time highs, and the secular bull market is going to get right back on track.
Dan, do you think maybe one of the reasons we've seen these sideways corrections is we're at historical low interest rates? We did a show a couple of weeks ago talking about German bonds and gilts getting to levels that we haven't seen since the Bank of England was founded. So if you're looking at investors, whether you're an institution or an individual, where are you going to put your money? I mean, you can put it in bonds and, you know, a third of sovereigns around the world are negative. If you put it in treasuries, I mean, you can get higher yields in stocks. I mean, this is the first time I've seen it in my career where stocks actually offer higher yields than what you can get in bonds.
Yeah, sure. You know, we look at that as well. You know, you look at the S&P yield differential, you know, what the S&P offers in yield in terms of the 10-year note yield. And you can see that it's very favorable for equities. I mean, our thesis here is that even despite a multiple of 18, 20 times on the S&P, U.S. equities is still really one of the more attractive asset classes relative. And that's a key term here, relative to the other choices available to investors. I think that one of the biggest, I hate using the term black swan, but one of the biggest disruptors coming is the generational top in the bond market, in the U.S. Treasury market. So we look at markets in terms of cycles. We have determined that there's an equity market cycle, you know, 10 to 15 years. And we've also, and you and I have talked about this in the past, you know, there's a commodity cycle. Well, there's also an interest rate cycle, you know, in the U.S. That's really our focus. And where the equity cycles are anywhere 10 to 15 years in duration, average interest rate cycle in this country, going back to the Industrial Revolution, believe it or not, is anywhere from 30 to 40 years in length. So if you look at our most recent progression, 1982 was the peak of long rates here, at least, you know, in modern history for, you know, most of us investors that were around at the time. 10-year note was trading around 14%. So over the course of 30 years, we've gotten down to where we are today. Our theory is that interest rates are now putting in a generational low, a generational base, and will eventually turn higher. And that's why we label our current market trend a reflationary market cycle. We think there's going to be continued multiple expansion against a higher interest rate environment. Now, the key to this that we look at is that these bases in interest rates can take upwards of 10 years to form. So effectively, our last analog that we have to this would be the 1940s period, coming right after the Great Depression. Rates at the long end were range-bound right around the level that they're trading at today and stuck at this level for nearly a decade in the early 1940s. And against that period, we had multiple expansion, we had some economic recovery, but it was still very much a stubbornly low-rate environment. So I think that's really kind of where we are today. In terms of talking about, you know, where do investors go? Okay, if you're not an institution where your mandate says you have to be, you know, trading equities, whether it's global equities, you know, U.S. equities, whatever sector you're in, you know, most retail investors especially, and if you're talking about baby boomer or older in terms of U.S. investors, they're actually still on the sidelines in the bond markets, in treasuries, in municipals, and actually sitting in cash. And they're willing to withstand these sort of historically low yields because their risk tolerance is so low, given what they've experienced over the last 15 years. Remember, we talked about those huge cyclical market swings that investors have gotten used to since the year 2000, since the tech bubble. That's basically created a gun-shy investor, specifically when you look at the demographics of baby boomer or older. You're talking about the millennial investor. They are not driving this tape yet. They're still too young. They do not have a lot of net worth. They're not aggressively involved yet. So, again, we think that's kind of the function here. You know, where are people hiding out? Well, it's cash. It's the bond market. And those that have equity exposure, where have they been hiding? Dividend payers, right? I mean, you look at something like AT&T, to your point. AT&T pays a current yield north of 4%. That's against a 10-year note yield of around 160, 170. So we're seeing where the U.S. equity market exposure is being concentrated in, and that's sort of in these blue chip, safer haven dividend payers. So again, what this is developing here is really a very crowded trade in sort of this yield scene. And so that could very well be the next disruptor. As I said, my belief is we are building a generational low in interest rates. Eventually, they are going to turn higher. Eventually, we do see money flow rotating off the sidelines, out of cash, out of the bond markets, and back towards equities, with the added benefit of the new investor, which is going to be effectively the millennial, in my opinion, who's not quite ready for prime time. But for now, they're still in bonds, as crowded as it is, as low as interest rates are, and they are in dividend payers.
Dan, let's talk about some of the best performers this year, which just really got beaten up over the last 3 years, which have been material stocks. I'm talking about precious metals, talking about the energy sector. Energy stocks have been doing very well this year, as well as gold stocks. So what's your take on gold and oil here, and especially those sectors in terms of performance?
Our theory holds that commodities and equities have historically been competing asset classes. So what that suggests to us is that when equities are in a multiple expansion cycle, commodities tend to be in a structural bear cycle or trading range as money flow gravitates, away from one and towards the other. Our belief is that we're in a secular bull in equities for the U.S., and so we're in a sort of structural trading range for commodities. We expect them to underperform on a relative basis. That being said, you can witness several cyclical swings in commodities on a trading basis. And I think to the extent where, gold prices, precious metals, and especially crude oil prices, coming into the new year, were extremely oversold on a historical basis, you sort of have this natural sort of vacuum. Investors gravitate back towards those types of asset classes. So on a short-term basis, we are, advocating exposure to energy. We think crude oil prices can actually reflate a little bit higher. We're looking for crude prices in terms of any type of ceiling. We don't think it would ever get north of $70, minus any sort of geopolitical shock. But we certainly think it could gravitate higher from here. But again, would settle somewhere, high 50s, 60s, 70s, kind of pushing the high end of it. And we tend to think that from a trading perspective, that's a good opportunity for investors at this point. So we do think commodities are looking better on a cyclical basis. So we are using them and utilizing those vehicles as a trading opportunity. From a secular perspective, though, we think stocks are still where it's at. That would hold true for gold. I mean, gold is obviously a safe haven trade. And as we mentioned before, what do you got? The three big things, Brexit has been disturbing the markets, U.S. election season coming up, disturbing the markets, obviously uncertainty surrounding Fed policy and what they're going to do with rates. This is causing, a lot of safe haven rotation that has benefited gold, which came into the new year, again, similar to oil, very oversold relative to the equity markets. So we do think it's really a technical development where you're seeing some mean reversion in the marketplace. So we do like gold. Do we think it's in a secular bull market here? No. We're not calling for Armageddon. We're not calling for gold prices to spike in any meaningful way. We're using it as a cyclical vehicle.
So we began our discussion talking about probably since November of 2014, we've been in this sideways trading range. Dan, what would you look for to tell you, okay, we've finally broken that trend? Would it be a sustained move above 2100? Would it be wide participation of stocks? Would it be leadership by certain sectors? What would you be looking at to make that confirmation?
I would say it's all things except, which sectors lead. What we found, believe it or not, was that through the course of any bull market, sector rotation is taking place constantly. So leadership position is always sort of changing. Right. Obviously people would worry, well, if you had energy. Well, we had a good point during the 82 to 2000 bull market where energy actually was a big contributor. We had a big point where financials were a huge leader. And so you can see that progression when we study the history of past bull markets. But to answer your question, obviously S&P, you want to see it break out, but breadth. Breadth is key. And one of the things I would urge, investors to watch is the NYSE Composite Index. This is one of the broadest measures that we have for the U.S. equity market. It's, a few thousand stocks of small, mid, and large cap. And so what we can see here is where the S&P is just trading really inches of its all-time highs under that 21-35 zone, that little kind of zone there. The NYSE is actually well below its prior highs. So one of the things that would really convince me is not only get the S&P above 2100, you can't have everybody battling into large caps and that driving without that market breadth. So I would like to see 2100 on the S&P. Obviously, it was 10.6 is an initial breakout on the NYSE composite. That's not even the highs. I think you got to take it well north of 11,000 on the NYSE composite. And then that's going to tell me that, okay, the S&P is doing what it's supposed to be doing in terms of its price action. And then I have breadth and participation doing what it's supposed to be doing. Remember, we want investors buying equities as an asset class sort of altogether relative to the other choices. We don't want them crowding into one or two stocks or just one or two safe haven sectors. Whenever you have that thin type of participation, tells me the market technicals aren't really all that healthy. We're probably in for more choppy weather. But when you have that breadth and that participation and sort of the engine firing on all cylinders is how I like to put it, then, yeah, that gives me much more conviction. So, you know, we're not there yet. I have hope. I like the breadth readings that I'm seeing. I like the fact that sentiment is really skewed to the bearish camp and has been for a while. That's typically a positive because we know bull markets like to climb, you know, a wall of worry. I realize multiples are not perfect, but relative to the choices, I think this multiple can go, you know, significantly higher. In fact, my opinion is I don't think this bull market ends until you see a market multiple, you know, on the S&P somewhere 25, 27 times. So we still have some miles to travel in that regard. And again, some money is going to start flowing out of the bond markets once yields really start to break out. You talk about the yield markets, 10-year note yield is the benchmark we use. You're still trading around 170. To be honest, you're not going to have real fireworks in the interest rate markets until that 10-year note yield takes out like 3 or 4%. I mean, the trading range in yields at this point, at these historically low levels, is very, very wide. And so we ask ourselves, you know, can you have multiple expansion, economic expansion, you know, at a 10-year note yield of 2.5%, 3%, 3.5%, 4%? You know, and the answer is absolutely you can, because you're still at these ridiculously low levels from a historical perspective at a time when, you know, labor participation is slowly improving. Labor participation in key demographics, 25 to 55. Labor participation there is still 81%. It's very healthy. Labor participation with the millennials, very healthy. My opinion is that the new workers, the new millennials are getting absorbed into the workforce. The economy is trying to grow and accommodate them as fast as they can, but it is feeling some growing pains. But ultimately, we are on a growth trajectory, and I think the multiple is going to continue to discount that. And again, breakout of 2100 S&P is one thing we're looking at. Breadth and the NYSE composite, I'd say that's key. That's what we're going to be watching.
Well, listen, Dan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so?
Yeah, the best is to reach out to me via email. My email is dwantrobski, it's dwantrobski at newalbionpartners.com. That's our firm in New York City.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on my program today is Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn. He is a researcher and clinician at the Cleveland Clinic. He's an Olympic gold medalist. He also was awarded the Bronze Star as an Army surgeon in Vietnam. And he's the author of a book, Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease. Doctor, each year, hundreds of thousands of Americans will die of heart disease. It is America's number one killer. In fact, as you wrote in your book, we are spending $250 billion a year on heart disease. But with all that money spent, why haven't we come up with a cure?
We have to really look at the rest of the globe to understand why this isn't working. For example, if you happen to be a cardiac surgeon and you were going to hang out your shingle either in Okinawa or the Papua Highlands in New Guinea, rural China, Central Africa, or the Tarahumara Indians in northern Mexico, forget it. You better plan on selling pencils. Why? Because there is no cardiovascular disease in these areas. Why? Because they all thrive on whole food plant-based nutrition without oil. And cardiovascular disease is really virtually unknown. and non-existent in these areas. So it's the money that is spent in this country is on procedures and drugs and operations and imaging, which have absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with the causation of the illness. And really, there's been a basic covenant of trust since the days of Hippocrates that wherever possible, the caregiver will share with the patient what is the causation of the illness. And sadly today, this is not being done with cardiovascular medicine. Not because cardiovascular medicine doesn't really want to help their patients. It's just because nutrition, for example, is never taught in medical school, and nutrition is never taught in any of the cardiologists in their postgraduate training. So they are really ill-equipped to deal with the causation of the illness, which they are responsible for trying to help.
One of the big investors of market turmoil with the Brexit exit has been one of the oldest investments around. Gold and silver. Joining me on the program is Dave Morgan from the Morgan Report. You know, Dave, it was probably one of the most fascinating evenings that I have had in a long time. I watched the evening news over dinner last night, and they were going with Britain decides to remain, which was the early polling results. At least that's what the polls were telling everybody. So I turned my TV off, and I thought, you know, a couple hours later, I had to check in and just see to confirm. So I turned on Bloomberg Television, and it was still they were going to remain. And then within a half an hour, it began to flip. And when it did, you saw the largest gyrations in market. Futures market, the Dow was down over 700 points, the S&P over 100. Gold, I think, at one point in the evening got up by almost $80. Silver was skyrocketing. The pound was down 10%. They were even talking about traders were so busy at their desks, they were bringing them food. They couldn't leave. So much trading. But let's talk about the metals market, because it was clearly a beneficiary of all this turmoil.
Absolutely. My story is similar to yours. I won't belabor it, but I'd actually done an update for the website members based on the early polls. And luckily, my webmaster, which usually is kind of my quality control, caught it and said, I don't think it's over yet. And then I had a very sleepless night because of the amount of contacts I have through London. I kept getting text. So I basically was up past midnight looking at the results and everything you just said, what the futures market was doing and how gold and silver were taking off.
So when you see that, Dave, you know, one of the things that we have seen periodically, maybe not so much for the last 3.5 years when gold was in its descent, investors were looking at other asset classes. They were investing in bonds, sovereign bonds. They were investing in stocks. And we had a 3.5 year decline in precious metals, despite the fact that the Fed was printing money, the European Bank was printing money, Japan was printing money. But things changed in February, beginning with a change in the Fed announced on Capitol Hill and Japan going to negative interest rates. What do you think makes it different now? Is it negative interest rates?
Jim, that's correct. Negative interest rates certainly plays a great deal into this. I mean, I've spent some time in recent weeks talking about what does it mean for a negative interest rate. I mean, basically, you're saying it's safer to loan your money, quote unquote, to a government authority to get back less than to hold hard cash, which doesn't lose any interest. I mean, this is absolute insanity. But moving on, I'll go to the touchstone of the extra upside down pyramid, which is a good model for the financial system. And from the very top to the very bottom, it comes down to the liquidity squeeze, which means that as trust and confidence are lost in the system throughout the global empire, that people seek safety, which tends to move into currencies, actually physical currencies, as I just said about the negative interest rates. And then there's the run to gold. And what we've seen with the Brexit is the run to gold has beginning. So if you take the run to gold basis, this challenge to the euro, and you think about all the other nation states that have the potential to do the same thing, I think you see the magnitude that could go into the gold market in the ensuing years. So the touchstone of all is basically the physical metals. And I know you're going to ask, you're going to add on a little bit and we can discuss further, why is gold outperforming silver? And there's a really good reason that isn't really discussed very often. And that is the VAT, the value added tax. So for the average person in the UK, you can buy gold with a slight premium for the dealer and for the coinage, et cetera, and buy gold. But if you want to buy silver, there is a tremendous value added tax that is paid in addition to the slight markup for mintage and the dealer fee. And that discourages the purchase of silver. If that VAT did not exist, I believe that a lot of people that wouldn't have the ability to buy gold would buy silver, and you'd probably see silver performing as well as, if not better than gold at this moment in time.
So let's talk about the metals and some of the drivers and possible limitations of it as well. I mean, if you take a look at metals did very well in the last decade, but it was a decade, Dave, leading up to the financial crisis. We saw emerging markets. We saw strong economic growth. We saw tremendous money being created in the Chinese economy, allowing Chinese to buy gold. Also, we've seen in that period of time, we've seen a whole new asset class emerge as an investment vehicle. We saw ETFs, GLD, SLV. We saw a lot more mining companies. Contrast that environment and the creation of these vehicles today and the way money flows around the globe to, let's say, where we began the last decade.
Okay, well, I'm going to back up a bit and talk about Rick Santelli that I met for the first time outside of the CME many, many years ago. And we struck up a conversation. This was back in the early 2000s. And I was telling him, you know, who I was, what I did. And of course, I knew who he was. He's pretty famous. But he said, oh, you know, gold, I just don't see gold going anywhere. There are so many financial products out there that compete with gold. It's not like it was in 1980, which is basically a reiteration of what you just said. And I agreed with him, but I also said that in the ultimate authority, you're going to see a run to gold. And I've always believed that. So is there competition? You bet. If it wasn't for the massive amount of paper derivatives throughout the entire markets, and especially in the metals markets, you would see a different price mechanism that would take place because you'd be dealing with, you know, physical reality rather than the paper paradigm. Having said that, when we really get the next leg up in the precious metals, you will see anything, derivative or not, that will take off because it has gold or silver in the name, which means you'll see, you know, a lot of junior mining stocks that really don't have any merit at the end of the market. You don't see them now. The ones that are there now are primarily just barely hanging on, and usually most of them have some merit to them. Regardless, what I see ahead is pretty much what I did in the outline in the Four Horsemen film that I was involved with many, many others that talked about the end of the Age of Empire. And this is where we are. This is where we're going. There's no stopping it. It's a mathematical certainty. And if you don't have the ability to see what's right in front of you, then there's going to be a heavy price to pay.
So let's talk about where we are right now. We have negative interest rates. We have, it's amazing, we did a show a couple of weeks ago about the lowest interest rates in recorded history. And every single week, Dave, and especially now with Brexit, they've gone even lower. So we have interest rates that are near zero, negative in many parts of the world. If you loan the government money, you actually have to pay them interest instead of receive interest. So that has got to be favorable for gold. You have gyrations going on in the market. You have the possibility of the breakup of the euro. They're now talking about Nexit, which country next wants to break away from the heavily regulated European Union, which many have felt would never hold together. So given this, and also the way the markets work, the one thing about the gold market, it's not like the stock market where you see it gradually rise and go up as companies report better earnings or the economy improves. How do you see this market unfolding? Because the one thing about gold is just like what we're talking on this Friday. It could be up 5% in a single day. And certainly we've seen similar moves in the past decade where gold could be up 10% in a single day.
Well, I believe we're getting set for the largest financial move in the precious metals, probably in recorded history. I just listened to an interview with another interviewer that interviewed Jim Sinclair and Bill Holter. And Jim Sinclair made the comment that when this thing really comes to the end and the unraveling really, really takes place, that it will be talked about by our children's children's children. I would go about that far, whether or not that's the point. The real deal is what you asked me. You know, where is it going next? Well, obviously, if the Brits can exit, then who is next? Is it Italy? Is it Spain? Who will come to the fore? And what is sought, and that again is safety. And because of that, as you said, you can see a gold move at, you know, 5-10%. Get ready for the volatility. This is what we're going to see in the future. And as we've said on your show many times, it is going to be the bull market of all bull markets, and this will shake a lot of people out. As I coined the phrase on your program, Jim, the market will scare you out or wear you out. There's going to be so much volatility in the years ahead, and I think just ahead, the next two or three, that a lot of people that think they can trade this market will be very happy and very sad within a week's time frame, which means they might see a $100 move in gold over a week's time frame and with leverage made a lot of money, only to see the market closed and limit up and then reopens maybe 200 higher. I'm exaggerating somewhat for effect, but I want people to get the idea of, you know, the Jesse Livermores, the Poplavas, the people out there that really have studied markets intensely, such as myself, that for most people, the best strategy is to buy high quality, lesser quality, and maybe speculate somewhat and buy and hold for the long term. And the long term, in my view, isn't going to be that long. I don't think we can go another 5 years. The math is just leaning too hard on an exponential function. And this is why, you know, people like myself, when we see an exponential curve, such as what happened in the silver market in 2011, even as bullish as I was and felt that from a fundamental aspect, silver actually probably was still fair valued at 50, but I also know the exponential curve and the margins were being raised, et cetera, and I called the top and I was correct. So very interesting times ahead, Jim. And let me just emphasize that to be protected, you don't want to put everything into the precious metals. As much as you might agree philosophically, as much as it makes sense, this is a place to be hedged, not necessarily pledged. So don't pledge everything you have to the philosophy of real money, honest money, the system's corrupt, and everything else you might be thinking. Hedge that, because this has gone on a lot longer than some of us have thought it may. And also, there's always the possibility. The human spirit is really unbounded in many ways. And because of that, there will be solutions that are taking place as we speak. I've devoted a lot of time in the fintech, the financial technology sector, because there is competition to the banking system. And this is what people are seeking. Bitcoin, of course, is the most well-known example, but there are others out there. And just like in the internet boom in the early 2000s, when would it be Amazon or would it be this or that, some off. Some front runners don't do that well. I'm not saying Bitcoin's going away by any stretch of the imagination. What I'm saying is there will be competition in a free market, what little of it remains, and there are days ahead which will be brighter than they are right now, but we collectively as people on the planet are going to be put through some interesting times to basically test our metal. And I don't mean M-E-T-A-L, I mean M-E-T-T-L-E. So, Jim, I really, really would like to emphasize that you need balance. You need balance in your portfolio. You need to look at the energy sector. You need to look at up and comers, and you need to be hedged in the metals. And that, in my view, is the smart, intelligent way to play the days ahead.
I'm glad to hear you say, Dave, that you want to be hedged, but you don't want to put everything into precious metals, because there are a lot of people in the gold industry that are saying, you know, this is the only thing you need. Put all your money in metals. And we know that is not good or sound investment advice. You know, we've had a lot of experts here, and I think the most that I've ever heard anybody say, if you were really aggressive, you were young, and you were speculative, maybe up to 20%, which seems rather high. But, you know, I've talked to gold fund managers. I've talked to Barron Roundtable members. None of them have recommended more than 10%. So that 10% figure seems to be the what would be considered reasonable, because that's what you're doing with gold. It's kind of like buying insurance.
Yeah, it is in a lot of ways. I mean, I don't really like the insurance connection, but I do. I mean, it's okay. It is. Basically, it's a hedge. It's an insurance play, if you want to call it that. I think it's more than that in this pertinent exact time in history. I mean, very rarely do you get a point in monetary history where we are right now, which means that the basic system is going to fail. And the idea if you look at a lot of analysts, is that no matter what happens, the government will take care of you. It's sort of the big daddy syndrome, I call it, that, you know, I'm not responsible for myself. There's somebody bigger, better, more authoritative than I am to take care of me. And if something goes wrong with the banking system or this or that, you know, daddy's going to make it better. Well, I've got news for you, folks. All you need to do is a cursory look at history. If you look at Taylor's book, Collapse of Complex Societies, you realize these things happen all the time. And referring back to that film, the Four Horsemen film, you see how empires evolve. It's a cycle that takes place again and again and again. We are at that cycle, but it's a rare event. People that recognize it will be able to hedge or insure or make use of what's going to take place and come out financially. But this will be bigger than financially. This is going to be something that's going to depend a lot on your attitude, because there are going to be times and instances where money alone won't save you. For example, a lot of people in my generation thought that freedom is financial freedom. If you had, you know, financial freedom, you had freedom. And in a lot of aspects, that's absolutely true. But at the end of an era like we're approaching, there will be so many distortions and discontinuities and protectionism and all the things that follow with these kind of collapses that you may not be able to purchase something that you take for granted today, no matter how much money you have.
Very good and sound advice. Well, listen, Dave, so if we were to sum it up right now, if you were to put money, would you put money in the market at this time? Or do you think when gold pops like it did on this Friday and overnight, that you should wait for a pullback? Would you be going into bullion, or would you be going into the metal stocks?
I'm going to answer in general, and then I'll answer for myself. So if you're not invested in any positions, you need physical metal, and do it now. And what do I think is going to happen? I'm doing an update after this interview for my premium members on the website membership. And it's basically falling in line almost exactly with what I said about a week ago when I did an update for everyone, if this Brexit did take place. So on a short-term basis, I won't tell you, because it really doesn't matter. I want people to focus more on the principles and the fundamentals and the long-term analysis. If you are already in a core position of physical metals, certainly you might look at the miners. For me personally, I'm pretty well at the limit I want. I do have my trading account cashed up. I'm looking at my own work, and I'm not going to give it over the show, but I am looking to get into some leveraged positions in the not-too-distant future. Markets run on emotion. There's probably more emotion in the market today than we've seen in quite some time. I'm going to do one of my favorite adages at Jim. You've heard me say it almost every show: when in doubt, stay out. Personally, I'm staying out for a while because I'm covered regardless of which way those markets go, be it the equity markets, the bond market, or the metals markets, covered in all areas. So I'm going to just relax and watch the emotions fly back and forth. I want to thank you again, Jim, for having the honor of being on your show. You are certainly one of the thought leaders. You've been in many movies, and you've certainly held the course, you know, steady hand on the tiller. And we need more of that. We need more people with character and integrity that are pretty steady Eddie. I know we've taken our hits as far as people that bend with the wind, but those of us that have a strong hand on the tiller are still majestically sailing forward. So thank you, Jim.
All right, Dave, as we close, you want to give out your website?
Please, everyone, realize that I have rebranded to themorganreport.com. Certainly, silver has taken up a great deal of my life, and I haven't lost any of my silver status, but I'm much more than that. So because of that fact, I've moved to themorganreport.com. We look primarily at the resource sector, so it's certainly not silver exclusive. It's all kinds of resource stocks, opportunities. And we also are looking ahead at the financial technology sector, because I want to be able to lead people through the peak in the metals markets into what I hopefully can find as one of the next big things. So, Jim, thank you for that.
Now, coming up next for the big picture today, you'll never guess what it is we're going to discuss. You did already, huh? Yeah, the Brexit, right. We're going to look at everything that happened in the 24 hours between Thursday night and Friday night as far as the markets and the implications of what has happened all day long, as well as Keith Barron will join us for a similar analysis from the point of view of someone who lives in Switzerland. So quite a bit packed into the next hour. Stay with us as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.